Well, I knew that there's always resistance to LGBT rights almost everywhere, and when these issues first become visible, there's a large kind of process that ensues where people need to be persuaded. But what I didn't expect so much was that some of these opposition movements, given that they were usually so nationalist and so locally focused, that they could be working so effectively across borders.
I hope that people will understand that moral conservative resistance and critique of liberal values and LGBTI rights in particular are a transnational phenomenon. That's something that needs to be studied in a global optic and not only on the national level.
For all the coffee lovers here, you'll be happy to know that Philip Ayoub is one of you because he loves coffee and he even opened the shop. But sadly for you, he didn't go on with this, and that's why he did this postdoc in Florence 10 years ago, and that's where he met Christina Stockel. Now they are both of them professors at the university, so at University College London for Philip and at Lewis University for Christina. Together, they are publishing this book, The Global Fight Against LGBTI Rights, and this is what we're going to talk about in this episode. So if you find it interesting, I can only encourage you to get it, and I'll put a link in the description so that you can get the book.
You have published a book entitled The Global Fight Against LGBTI Rights. Can you tell us what is this fight about?
Mm-hmm. So, I can tell you a little secret, because our working title for the book was not Fight. That was the editorial choice to call the book The Global Fight Against LGBTI Rights. Uh-huh. We worked with the title The Global Resistance to LGBTI Rights. And resistance, in a way, catches more what we are really talking about, because it's undeniable that starting in the 1980s, groups working towards obtaining more equal rights for LGBTI people have achieved successes all over the world. I mean, especially in the Western world, it started with the decriminalization of homosexuality. Now we are discussing same-sex marriage, the right to adopt children. So LGBTI issues have in a way become, you know, more mainstream, more normal. It's no longer taboo. It's no longer criminalized. It's no longer stereotypically talked about as it was in the past. So when we talked about resistances, we actually meant resistances to precisely that development. And it's also true, though, that these resistances then develop into fights, because in the end it comes down to a fight of groups that are against equal rights for queer, homosexual, transsexual people and those who are for them. So in the end we are talking about a fight between two normative views.
And the reason that that's quite interesting for us also in political science and sociology is that we often saw these kind of global or cosmopolitan networks around human rights as really being the domain of more progressive activists, because, you know, women's rights or queer people's rights they feel some connection across borders with that, you know, because there's some elements of their identity that are shared and some elements of the struggle that are shared in different places. Whereas a lot of these moral conservative movements was a bit different in that, you know, a lot of them had very deeply held national convictions, very deeply held religious convictions that, at least for theory, made it harder to imagine them working transnationally and cooperatively in a really active way. And what Christine and I were noticing is that these transnational tools that helps LGBTI people win many rights in many different places are increasingly being used by their opposition as well. And in that process, there's kind of a mimicry also of how these conservative movements are using some of the spaces that LGBTI people used before, whether that's international courts or whether it's talking about in a human rights language, but even kind of manipulating human rights language to talk about, you know, religious liberty or rights of the family or rights of cis women, construct in a way that makes them as a wedge between LGBT people. This is something that we increasingly see being used in the transnational space. And we also see transnational advocacy organizations that are organizing, you know, big summits where activists from around the world come together and talk about certain issues that often feature LGBTI people, and then they get picked up and become kind of either political rhetoric or policy initiatives in many different places. So you can see an issue like, you know, so-called anti-gay propaganda bills appearing in multiple countries. The book is, it's quite a big book, has a lot of parts, but to just give a very small summary, we see this kind of dynamic of, you know, transnational advocacy among also anti-LGBT activists, and we try to understand, you know, how that works, how it comes together, and also what that means for LGBTI organizing in response.
The main theoretical outcome of the book is that model of the double helix of norm mobilization. But basically observe and then try to put into a theoretical model the fact that LGBTI groups and many other progressive NGOs and civil society have achieved their goals by mobilizing outside of the national constituencies, maybe on the level of international institutions, at the UN or the European Union, or even also by using courts, and then achieve their goals on the level of policies. And what we now see is that conservative groups do precisely the same. They mobilize outside of their national constituencies, they go to the courts, they go to the UN, they go on the level of the EU. And so the argument of the double helix is that progressive and conservative groups move strategically in very similar ways, and paradoxically, even in terms of topics, they move in very similar ways. So they focus on issues, and the way they frame issues, they are like mirrors vis-a-vis each other. That's what we try to catch with the double helix model.
And do you think, I mean, this mirror is like they just thought, you know, what's the best way to counter, to resist LGBTI rights? Is this to go to fight with the same tools that they use? Or do you think it's more spontaneously because LGBTI rights took some ways to be promoted, then the natural resistance is to use the same tools to counterbalance, to counterattack?
Now, I think it's probably really true that progressive NGOs were the first to realize that mobilizing on the level of international institutions garners them success, and rightly so, because think about many national context of elections, especially LGBTI issues were not in the forefront of mainstream political parties. We are talking here about minority rights, about sexual minority groups that are marginalized in a society. So in order to have a louder voice, it makes sense for them to mobilize across borders, to connect with others. And this worked. And that's very much, that's also what social movement literature has theorized and has worked on for many years. And the idea always was that the resistance to these movements would then mostly happen in the national context. It would be local it would be national, it would be domestic, it would be resistance against something that's coming in a way out of that mobilization. And what we show in the book is that this resistance now follows the same pattern. It's not that we have a progressive group and then kind of, you know, a conservative, stable resistance against it or criticism against it. No, they are both very mobile, very interconnected, transnationally connected.
I think the book is rather focused on how this fight or resistance is unfolding or is structured and organized. And can you maybe tell us more why there is a fight or resistance needed in the first place? Like, why there are some people who feel attacked if it's a fight or a resistance?
Yeah. Now, Philip and I are political sociologists, and I think this is why we are driven to the how question.
Yeah.
We want to understand how these conflicts unfold. But in the how question, there is also already part of the why answer. Why do they unfold? Because A major argument in the book is precisely that the fight over LGBTI rights in many contexts is not actually at all about homosexuality, sexuality, gender. Mm-hmm. It's really a fight about what, about liberal democracy, about individual rights, about the status of international human rights. It's become almost a kind of token fight today, where many authoritarian and autocratic governments lash out against groups that are already vulnerable by depicting them as vanguards of westernization or liberalization that then in those countries are not welcome. I mean, Russia is a very good example for that. So this is why the how question, to a certain extent, is also part of the why question.
If you think about, you know, the fluidity of concepts like gender and sexuality that are felt or they're easy to mobilize against as something destabilizing because you have, you know, movements around gender, sexuality, gender identity are asking us to rethink core concepts of how we live, you know, core concepts of how we accept people and let them live their lives. And I think for a lot of right-wing movements, there's kind of a knee-jerk reaction to kind of present this as a threat and to present, you know, nationalism or religious tradition or certain traditional values as something more fixed, more stable. I mean, I disagree with that. I think that those are all imaginations, that things were so much more fixed or stable mm-hmm. or simple, you know, back in the day. But at the same time, it's easy for proponents of these movements to really present LGBTI people as kind of changing too much or changing things of these more fixed categories because of their fluidity, and that makes them become a big target in these movements. I don't think that, you know, a real political concern right now is something like Drag Queen Story Hour, which a lot of these populist politicians, right-wing populist politicians, are targeting as, you know, a major threat or a concern that we have to talk about, whether in the U.S. or in Brazil or in Germany. But they nonetheless can bring this up as a topic of political concern because it symbolizes something, some change, symbolizes something that can easily be manipulated as a threat. And I think that's part of why LGBTI people and their issues can factor into some of these movements as well.
Okay, so I get the idea that it can be easily manipulated as a threat, like you're saying. And that would mean that it's also, let's say, used as a strategy to get elected, so strategically. Do you think there is also something which is more deeply, that it's not only strategically, because that would be saying that it's just a tool, but they don't really believe in it, but that mm-hmm. really deep inside them, they have some very strong belief that this is a bad thing, this LGBT movement, mm-hmm. and that it's actually harming them?
I think it's a mix of both. I mean, I think there's a lot of strategy involved in this movement, a lot of political elites who manipulate some of these issues. I do think they're being strategic, and I think it would be, you know, the fact that there's a lot of learning, like in the book that Christine and I study around these networks and how some of these issues crop up in multiple different countries, some of these perceived or constructed threats. That means there's some strategy involved in terms of how they are, you know, they're not local issues of concern about things that are affecting people's lives negatively in their society. Instead, they're really used in a strategic way as a cookie cutter thing to strike up certain emotions. They're used to galvanize, galvanize support for political campaigns. At the same time, there are people who accept some of these messages and do feel, you know, based on certain convictions, you know, moved and swayed by them. And I think for those people, it's also fair to say there's something, you know, that is not just strategy, that there's something, some real attachment to these ideas, that they resonate with people. And these ideas, but I, My sense is that they're also, you know, people are also easily manipulated by this strategy. And so a lot of times gender folds into all sorts of issues in ways that might make sense to people, might resonate with them in a genuine way, but nonetheless is leaving out, you know, a lot of the strategy behind it. And so you can think of, like, oftentimes LGBT rights are presented, you know, as against nature or against common sense or against the family or against religion. I don't think that most LGBT movements see themselves against the family. In fact, LGBT people have all sorts of really, families that are, and they put a lot of thought into actually creating more safe families, creating more chosen families, or families that work better than kind of the problems we've had with families in the past that involve a lot of misogyny, a lot of lack of safety in many cases, you know. And so queer people are thinking about all of these things, maybe even making some of these things better, but they're presented in these arguments as a threat to them. And I think that's where the genuine concern with the family can be manipulated in a strategic way to actually feel like there's some kind of disconnect.
Yeah. So, a big part of strategy that I think I'm underestimating, because I'm just going to give you my thought about this topic, because also my question was maybe a bit biased based on this experience, that I'm familiar with some people who find it like that is not a good idea, that it shouldn't, LGBT movement is something bad for society and so on. And I think also, even if it's used for strategy, for it to be efficient, probably you need to have people that it resonates into people, that they find it indeed relevant. Mm-hmm. And I'm just gonna suggest you theory or something, and you just tell me what you think about that. I think many people, and maybe not the majority, because I just don't know about statistics, but many people, they really deeply feel that something, they are being shaken too much. Let's say this, what they are used to, their comfort, their idea of the world is being so much shaken and so much, shaken by these ideas, that they actually, if there are some people who are already suffering economically, but also having a hard time in society, not feeling so much control and power over what's happening in society, mm-hmm. and then on top of that, there are some movements that are putting in question all their ideas about how the world should be, how family should be, how life should be. This is starting to be too much. And then if you have someone, a political leader, who says we should go back to traditional values, traditional family, and this is how we should, probably people have a lot of reason to endorse it, because they would feel much safer, much more in control, and much more stabilized in their views and in their perception of the world, and that would be less threatening for them. So for their well-being, let's say, this is makes a lot of sense that they support the people who are saying that wokeism or LGBT movements are going too far. I don't know if
I don't like the idea of connecting it to their well-being. I think that people can feel. You know, feel this, but at the end of the day, there's also, we have to think intersectionally about power and who are the people you're talking about. And that's also a bit of an imagination that maybe we're thinking of, like, a white working class people. There's a lot of poor people that have been left behind in terms of class reason that are not that type of a person, that also face a lot of marginalizations due to their race, their ethnicity. And I think that it's really the idea of thinking that, you know, making a scapegoat out of LGBT people and their families and their issues somehow hurts the well-being of other people. I do think that is, in my view, goes a little too far. It's a commonly used narrative, and I do understand that, you know, political leaders can mislead people, and I think that's wrong. And I do understand that people can be easily misled because of these feelings, you know, that the world just doesn't make sense anymore. And I think that there would be a lot of, you know, there is a lot of work LGBTI movements do to try to, explain, you know, like ideas around like love is love, or trying to explain how, you know, a lot of things that movements are asking for are just for simple recognition, and that would maybe need a lot more allyship as well from, you know, mainstream politicians, and they have received it in some cases, to kind of help explain why these movements are not asking for anything, you know, that would detract from the well-being of other people. They're just acknowledging that the way the world works, or how some people think it should work, has excluded, you know, many, many people. And not just now, I'm not just thinking about LGBT people, but you can think of all sorts of other marginalized people that have really been left out of this imagination of the good old days of how the world works. And without those changes, we're asking, you know, all of those people that have been excluded and left out of that picture to just be content with not being in it, or having their lives and their experiences not being represented. Most things that LGBT people are asking for, whether it's the right to have, you know, their families recognized, or get to have a family themselves, or it's the right to you know, feel protected, that there's no hate crimes against them. You know, one of the main concerns for trans activists is the intense violence that trans people face in so many countries and societies. And then their issues get manipulated in mainstream politics as if they're asking, you know, as presented as a threat, of course, and as if they're asking for all of these things that will radically change the world in some way, when, you know, most trans organizers don't see themselves in any way as wanting to take things away from the way other people live their lives, but certainly want a place also for trans people within our social fabric. And so I think it's a little bit like I have a harder time, I guess, feeling that, you know, that people should be given a free pass to say, I don't have to think about any changes in the world, or I have to think that my well-being is hurt by imagining the inclusion of some other group. I don't think that's how the world works, to say that we just like keep it simple. Nothing. We've never had an era that's been simple. I mean, people said this about civil rights and about, you know, desegregating our societies on the basis of race as well. I mean, and this idea that really bad things will happen if we become more inclusive is I think the premise of that in itself is quite problematic, even if it resonates with some people.
What is the method of the book? Are you relying on interviews? Is what I think I've seen.
Yes. No. We used a lot of interview material for the book.
Yeah.
Because the book is basically the fruit of two large-scale research projects. The first was a project by Philip, which was very much about the mobilization for LGBTI rights, trying to understand the SOGI rights movement, how it works, and also how it evolves in terms of topics and strategies. And then I was doing a research project on moral conservative mobilization against LGBTI rights, but not only. So I also looked at groups that mobilized against abortion, mobilized in the name of religious freedom, mobilized for traditional family values. Mm. And that research project, which was a large project, we gathered over 100 interviews with moral conservative activists from many different countries, and also from different faith traditions. So in the end, the research project that I draw on was a project that looked at the Russian Orthodox part in as non-mobilizer against liberal values. But not only, also the American Christian right and also European groups. So we had this large body, in a way, of interview material which we draw on. But it's not only the interviews, it's also, you know, as you gather those interviews, I attended many of these conventions, gatherings. It was really a journey through the moral conservative universe and how they mobilize against LGBTI rights.
Yeah, okay. And so you said you relied on many interviews, many material, many conferences. Is there any particular illustration or example that was striking for you in advancing, in doing your research, something that was...
There's a lot of things that we talk about how the movement works, but one way in terms of how using human rights language, I mean, there are several examples around that. So one could be some of these religious liberty examples to say that those are cases that kind of make an argument that based on religious conviction, it's okay to discriminate against LGBTI people. So if you feel like you're a web designer, I mean, many times these cases are actually fabricated, that they're kind of strategic litigation to get a case up. But there's one case, for example, in the US around a website designer who didn't want to make a website for like a gay wedding or kind of a gay event, and felt that her religious conviction didn't allow her to do that. Probably unlikely that many gay couples were using this website service, because it didn't seem like a very established or big business, but nonetheless, it ended up being a really major case. And this is a way to kind of try to create a precedent, and cases like this have appeared in different countries, to create a precedent to say that, you know, religious liberty can trump anti-discrimination protections towards queer people. There's other examples like the kind of Kim Davis cases from some years ago where a county clerk, you know, because of religious conviction, did not want to approve marriage licenses for gay people. There's other kind of cases that really present LGBTI people as a threat and to the family, or to kind of rights of the family, or increasingly with some of this anti-trans politics, oftentimes the rights of women, of cis women, are presented as in contradiction to the rights of trans women, both in rhetoric and also in the way that this human rights, you know, in general rhetoric, and the way that human rights rhetoric is used. But that is just one way these movements work. You know, there's also a lot of coordination around potential political themes and tropes that might resonate, you know, going back to our earlier conversation, or that might kind of, yeah, that might resonate politically in many different contexts. So you can see certain topics or narratives emerging in different places. So the idea that the LGBT rights are kind of neocolonialism or kind of outside or Western imposition is used in many countries. So you can see that, for example, coming from the Russian Duma, when the argument is that we're, you know, that just trying to justify an invasion of Ukraine by saying that the state is protecting it from Western decadence. And then there's a lot of talk about gay pride parades or trans people in kind of war rhetoric, which sounds bizarre almost, but is used in this way. We see that in some global South countries when there too you can see this idea that LGBT rights are painted as a kind of Western or colonial imposition. The irony there, of course, being that colonialism actually diffused anti-sodomy laws around much of the world, which was actually introducing homophobia that erased the queer local cultures, or at least made them much more invisible. So this is these are the ways some of these strategies develop, and it's easy to develop them in these movements because there are these networks that bring a lot of these thinkers together, where these arguments are proliferated, where they're connected to these kind of threat tropes that we talked about earlier.
One organization we worked on particularly was the World Congress of Families, which by now has become an organization that is studied by many scholars who look at conservative non-mobilization. It's an American NGO that was founded in the 1990s by an American and by a Russian, and it seeks to promote traditional family values by organizing global conferences on a regular level, by lobbying politicians. And so what I find very, very striking about the World Congress of Families is not only that it has existed for so many years, rather successfully, but that really the point of the whole organization is to weave a narrative, according to which liberal values are damaging to society, they're damaging to family, and they have to be resisted. And it's really very much about liberalism in a broad sense. It's not only about LGBTI rights. So when you attend these conferences, or also when you talk to people, there is always this sense of how they feel that they are on a slippery slope. Mm-hmm. You know? So the moment you give up on traditional gender roles, women leave the family and have a workplace, then eventually, you know, you'll have a disintegrating family, and then it will get worse, and then you will have, you know, same-sex marriage, and they feel like on a slippery slope very much. And this is also a way of seeing the world and seeing moral problems that was new for me. It's something that I, in a way, learned by being exposed to the environment very long, doing lots of interviews, trying to understand how people were reasoning. So yes, I think that understanding that mindset was really one thing I took away from it.
And when you present the findings, I mean the research, to some audience in these conferences, what is the reaction that you get?
It depends, of course, very much on the audience. So if you talk to people who are already working in the field of social mobilization, especially progressive LGBTI mobilization, the reaction I got was very often that people were surprised at how much insight we got into the moral conservative groups, mm-hmm. And with how much detail we can actually talk about their way of seeing and their strategies. And so these groups are interested in our findings for that reason. As a sociologist of religion, I have another audience as well, which I sometimes present these findings. Theologians working in the Orthodox Christian tradition, or also theologians and scholars working in the Catholic tradition. And they are also interested in that, because they realize that there are certain topics that have invaded their religious space as being really, really prominent. The traditional family, being against LGBTI rights, where very often they feel that that's actually not exclusively what, you know, our faith or our religion is about. And so there is, in some quarters of these religious constituencies, the sense that they're being colonized by the culture wars. And our research basically shows how that is happening. And that there are indeed groups that do that work of mainstreaming a conservative Christian worldview into something that then becomes very narrow, focused only on gender and sexuality and family, and forgets about other issues such as solidarity or poverty or hospitality. So that was also an interesting experience, how these two different constituents read the book in different ways.
Yeah, because it's true that when we think about LGBTI rights and the repression about that, we mostly think religion. Mm-hmm. And maybe you're right. I mean, maybe many people who are religious don't actually like to be reduced or to be so much put... in the front for highlighted for the about this topic.
Exactly. Apart from the fact that, of course, we also have, you know, religious Christian LGBTI groups. I mean, they're not many, but they exist. Mm. So I think also this strive for differentiation in the book is something that we try. Important.
Very important. And yeah, then another question that came to my mind. So they are when I think about LGBTI resistance, I think mostly religion, mm-hmm. Then I think maybe like traditional state and authoritarian states. And are these indeed the two driving forces, or they're actually the misrepresentation of it? What is driving the resistance against LGBTI rights?
Yeah. Now, I think in the case of the authoritarian and autocratic states, for example, Russia, it's pretty clear what is driving the resistance or the fight against LGBT rights on state level. A country like Russia is still nominally a democracy. So, you know, elections still take place. There are also societies where you still have a lot of stereotypical views about homosexuality, you know, especially with the Soviet legacy of homosexuality being criminalized until 1993. So it is actually a very easy topic on which to convince an audience that giving more rights to homosexual people is actually harmful for society. In the absence of a counter discourse, which is illegal in Russia, many people find that convincing. And in a context where you don't have open and free elections, but you still ask people for their opinion on the government, to push that button, to say, we are actually protecting you against that, unfortunately seems to a certain extent to work. It's also about restricting groups that are, by their inclination, probably more open to looking beyond Russia, to have international, transnational connections, to work with NGOs abroad. It's very much about restricting groups that have progressive views, that may actually have democratic demands, or probably really surely have democratic demands for equal rights. So it's also part of a whole program of repression of free speech, freedom of assembly. And I also think, and this has become very clear in the context of the spiral of repression now in Russia after the start of the full-scale war on Ukraine. You know, if you really zoom in on one population that becomes extremely vulnerable and fragile, basically you frighten society as a whole. I mean, if you can do that, if you can single out people who become the new scapegoats, you know, dividing society up like that becomes an easy tool. So I think from the perspective of autocratic authoritarian states, scapegoating LGBTI groups is unfortunately a way of boosting their authority, their legitimacy to the inside. It's also a very easy tool to say what makes us different from the West, because the West is constantly being depicted, in a way wrongly so, as the great promoter of LGBTI rights, which in a way is not true. I mean, there are many problems still in Western countries. But of course, progress has been made. And that progress is now being accused of being sort of bringing about the end of civilization. So it's really very much about, you know, creating a repressive environment to the outside and marking a distance to the other side.
In your political scientist, so mm-hmm. you do the how, you do the why, and you don't do the what should we do about that. Mm-hmm. But based on these findings, do you have any personal intuitions about what this means, these findings, maybe about the what's gonna happen soon in the future, and maybe some avenues to do something about it?
Yeah. Now, I think one thing that I take away from this study is that LGBTI rights are misunderstood in large parts of the world. So why is it that in many Western countries, LGBTI groups get equal recognition? It's because in a liberal democracy, people are equal and they have equal access to services, equal access to rights. And there is a principle of non-discrimination, and in the EU non-discrimination directive, which is a bureaucratic paragraph, but it's very nicely written. It's non-discrimination on the basis of sexuality, sexual orientation, gender, age, but also capability and disability. So it's really part of a package of thinking about people as equal, and I think this should be just again and again communicated. I'm very worried in a way now about the future EU enlargements, which will involve several majority Orthodox countries. So Serbia is a candidate country, Ukraine has become a candidate country, Moldova. Because there, the Orthodox Church is very much on the line of also the Russian Orthodox Church thinking about the EU as that great threat, because they will bring LGBTI rights. And I think it's very important to explain to people and to the publics what non-discrimination is about, why it is a basic principle of democracy, and not to allow the critics of LGBTI rights, those that use them in their fight against democracy, to use precisely only that topic. which they use because they find it easy to mobilize and people kind of intuitively think they understand what it's about. But it's not only about gender, sexuality, orientation. It's about non-discrimination. It's about equality.
Okay. And to sum up, going back to the book, generally, what do you hope that people will have understood with this book? If you could maybe, it's a hard exercise.
Oh, I hope that people will understand that moral conservative resistance and critique of liberal values and LGBTI rights in particular are a transnational phenomenon, that that's something that needs to be studied in a global public and not only on a national level.
The fact that they can come together and really put aside some of their differences around the deeply held religious convictions and work together in kind of conservative ecumenism, or that they can shed some of their deeply held national beliefs and kind of support the fellow nationalism of a person from another country. That was a bit surprising to me. That always seemed much more natural for queer people who were excluded from their nations everywhere. So the fact that they work transnationally to me was less surprising. And I think it still gives LGBT movements a leg up, and that's a much more natural bond across borders, I think, than their conservative opposition has. So maybe that will help sustain their movements a little bit more, but we'll see.
Thanks a lot for having listened to this episode. Last month, we started with this idea to have a mini challenge at the end of each episode. And this month, it's gonna be also very easy. Because it was about understanding this global movement, I would just like you to post a comment with something that surprised you or stood better about this global fight against LGBTI rights. I will note your participation, and on the 15th of the month, I will do a live stream on the social media where one of you will be randomly selected by the computer. This person will be lucky because this person will be able to choose between a mug, a notebook, or a tote bag that I will send to you for free. So enjoy! I'm waiting for your comments and see you on the 15th of the month for the live stream, and then on the 1st of November for the next episode.